private joke time, friends. God bless you, little life hutch, said Robert Silverberg, hauling Randall Garrett into a closet and locking the door. Put the robot in the wall, screamed Garrett, and Ellison heard, turning to John Campbell, who said, You can't lecture people, Harlan. Now here's why you can't lecture people, and began a 7-hour lecture. Private joke time is over, patient reader. Now read Life Hutch. Terence slid his right hand, the one out of sight of the robot, up his side. The razoring pain of the 3 broken ribs caused his eyes to widen momentarily in pain. Then he recovered himself and closed them till he was studying the machine through narrow slits. If the eyeballs click, I'm dead, thought Terence. The intricate murmurings of the life hutch around him brought back the immediacy of his situation. His eyes again fastened on the medicine cabinet, clamped to the wall next to the robot's duty niche.
Cliché. So near, yet so far. It could be all the way back on Antares base for all the good it's doing me, he thought.
And a crazy laugh rang through his head. He caught himself just in time.
Easy. 3 days is a nightmare, but cracking up will only make it end sooner.
That was the last thing he wanted, but it couldn't go on much longer. He flexed the fingers of his right hand. It was all he could move. Silently, he damned the technician who had passed the robot through, or the politician who had let inferior robots get placed in the life hutches so he could get a rake-off from the government contract, or the repairman who hadn't bothered checking closely his last time around. All of them. He damned them all. They deserved it. He was dying. His death had started before he had reached the life hutch. Terence had begun to die when he had gone into the battle. He let his eyes close completely, let the sounds of the life hutch fade from around him. Slowly, the sound of the coolants hush-hushing through the wall pipes, the relay machines feeding their messages without pause from all over the galaxy, the whirring of the antenna's standard, turning in its socket atop the bubble, slowly they melted into silence. He had resorted to blocking himself off from reality many times during the past 3 days. It was either that, or existing with the robot watching, and eventually he would have had to move. To move was to die. It was that simple. He closed his ears to the whisperings of the life hutch. He listened to the whisperings within himself.
Good God, there must be a million of them.
It was the voice of the squadron leader, Resnick, ringing in his suit intercom.
What kind of battle formation is that supposed to be? Came another voice.
Terence looked at the radar screen, at the flickering dots signifying Kyban ships.
Who can tell with those toadstool-shaped ships of theirs? Resnick answered. But remember, the whole front umbrella part is studded with cannon, and it has a hell of a range of fire. Okay, watch yourselves. Good luck, and give them hell.
The fleet dove straight for the Kyban Armada. To his mind came the sounds of war across the Gulf of Space. It was all imagination. In that tomb, there was no sound, yet he could clearly detect the hiss of his scout's blaster as it poured beam after beam into the lead ship of the Kyban fleet. His sniper-class scout had been near the point of that deadly Terran phalanx, driving like a wedge at the alien ships, converging on them in loose battle formation. It was then it had happened. One moment, he'd been heading into the middle of the battle, the left flank of the giant Kyban dreadnought turning crimson under the impact of his firepower. The next moment, he had skittered out of the formation which had slowed to let the Kyban craft overshoot, while the Earthmen decelerated to pick up maneuverability. He had gone on at the old level and velocity directly into the forward guns of a toadstool-shaped Kyban destroyer. The first beam had burned the gun mounts and directional equipment off the front of the ship, scorching down the aft side in a smear
like oxidized chrome plate. He had managed to avoid the second beam. His radio contact had been brief. He was going to make it back to Antares base if he could. If not, the formation would be listening for his homing beam from a life hutch on whatever planetoid he might find for a crash landing. Which was what he had done. The charts had said the pebble spinning there was technically 1-333-2A MNS 3-804.39 pound sign, which would have meant nothing but three-dimensional coordinates had not the small pound sign after the data indicated a life hutch somewhere on its surface. His distaste for being knocked out of the fighting, being forced onto one of the life hutch planetoids, had been offset only by his fear of running out of fuel before he could locate himself, of eventually drifting off into space somewhere to wind up finally as an artificial satellite around some minor sun. The ship pancaked in under minimal reverse drive, bounced high twice, and caromed 10 times, tearing out chunks of the rear section, but had come to rest a scant 2 miles from the life hutch, jammed into the rocks. Terence had high-leaped the 2 miles across the empty, airless planetoid to the hermetically sealed bubble in the rocks. His primary wish was to set the hutch's beacon signal so his returning fleet could track him. He had let himself into the decompression chamber, palmed the switch through his thick spacesuit glove, and finally removed his helmet as he heard the air whistle into the chamber. He had pulled off his gloves, opened the inner door, and entered the life hutch itself. "God bless you, little life hutch," Terence had thought as he dropped the helmet and gloves. He had glanced around, noting the relay machines picking up messages from outside, sorting them, vectoring them off in other directions. He had seen the medicine chest clamped onto the wall. The refrigerator, he knew, would be well stocked if a previous tenant hadn't been there before the stockman could refill it. He had seen the all-purpose robot, immobile in its duty niche, and the wall chronometer, its face smashed. All of it in a second's glance. God bless, too, the gentleman who thought up the idea of these little rescue stations, stuck all over the place for just such emergencies as this. He had started to walk across the room. It was at this point that the service robot that kept the place in repair between tenants and unloaded supplies from the ships had moved clankingly across the floor and, with one fearful smash of a steel arm, thrown Terence across the room. The spaceman had been brought up short against the steel bulkhead, pain blossoming in his back, his side, his arms and legs. The machine's blow had instantly broken 3 of his ribs. He lay there for a moment, unable to move. For a few seconds he was too stunned to breathe, and it had been that, certainly, that had saved his life. His pain had immobilized him, and in that short space of time, the robot had retreated with a muted internal clash of gears. He had attempted to sit up straight, and the robot had hummed oddly and begun to move. He had stopped the movement. The robot had settled back. Twice more had convinced him his position was as bad as he had thought. The robot had worn down somewhere in its printed circuits. Its commands to lift had been erased or distorted so that now it was conditioned to smash, to hit anything that moved. He had seen the clock. He realized he should have suspected something was wrong when he saw its smashed face. Of course, the digital dials had moved. The robot had smashed the clock. Terence had moved. The robot had smashed him, and would again, if he moved again. But for the unnoticeable movement of his eyelids, he had not moved in 3 days. He had tried moving toward the decompression lock, stopping when the robot advanced and letting it settle back, then moving again, a little nearer, but the idea died with his first movement. His ribs were too painful. The pain was terrible. He was locked in one position, an uncomfortable, twisted position. And he would be there till the stalemate ended, one way or the other. He was suddenly alert again. The reliving of his last 3 days brought back reality sharply. He was 12 feet away from the communications panel, 12 feet away from the beacon that would guide his rescuers to him. Before he died of his wounds, before he starved to death, before the robot crushed him. It could have been 12 light-years, for all the nearer he could get to it. What had gone wrong with the robot? Time to think was cheap. The robot could detect movement, but thinking was still possible. Not that it could help, but it was possible. The companies that supplied the Life Hutch's needs were all government contracted. Somewhere along the line, someone had thrown in impure steel or calibrated the circuit cutting machines for a less expensive job. Somewhere along the line, someone had not run the robot through its paces correctly. Somewhere along the line, someone had committed murder. He opened his eyes again, only the barest fraction of opening. Any more, and the robot would sense the movement of his eyelids. That would be fatal. He looked at the machine. It was not, strictly speaking, a robot. It was merely a remote-controlled hunk of jointed steel, invaluable for making beds, stacking steel plating, watching culture dishes, unloading spaceships, and sucking dirt from rugs. The robot body, roughly humanoid, but without what would have been a head on a human, was merely an appendage. The real brain, a complex maze of plastic screens and printed circuits, was behind the wall. It would have been too dangerous to install those delicate parts in a heavy-duty mechanism. It was all too easy for the robot to drop itself down a loading shaft, or to be hit by a meteorite, or to get caught under a wrecked spaceship. So there were sensitive units in the robot appendage that saw and heard what was going on and relayed them to the brain behind the wall. And somewhere along the line, that brain had worn grooves too deeply into its circuits. It was now mad. Not mad in any way a human being might go mad, for there were an infinite number of ways a machine could go insane. Just mad enough to kill Terrence. Even if I could hit the robot with something, it wouldn't stop the thing. He could, perhaps, throw something at the machine before it could get to him, but it would do no good. The robot brain would still be intact and the appendage would continue to function. It was hopeless. He stared at the massive, blocky hands of the robot. It seemed he could see his own blood on the jointed work tool fingers of one hand. He knew it must be his imagination, but the idea persisted. He flexed the fingers of his hidden hand. 3 days had left him weak and dizzy from hunger. His head was light and his eyes burned steadily. He had been lying in his own filth till he no longer noticed the discomfort. His side ached and throbbed, and the pain of a blast furnace roared through him every time he breathed. He thanked God his spacesuit was still on, lest the movement of his breathing bring the robot down on him. There was only one solution, and that solution was his death. He was almost delirious. Several times during the past day, as well as he could gauge night and day without a clock or a sunrise, he had heard the roar of the fleet landing outside. Then he had realized there was no sound in dead space. Then he had realized they were all inside the relay machines, coming through subspace right into the Life Hutch. Then he had realized that such a thing was not possible. Then he had come to his senses and realized all that had gone before was hallucination. Then he had awakened and known it was real. He was trapped, and there was no way out. Death had come to live with him. He was going to die. Terrence had never been a coward, nor had he been a hero. He was one of the men who fight wars because they are always fought by someone. He was the kind of man who would allow himself to be torn from wife and home and flung into an abyss they called space to defend what he had been told needed defense. But it was in moments like this that a man like Terrence began to think. Why here? Why like this? What have I done that I should finish in a filthy spacesuit on a lost rock? And not gloriously, like they said in the papers back home, but starving or bleeding to death alone with a crazy robot. Why me? Why me? Why alone? He knew there could be no answers. He expected no answers. He was not disappointed. When he awoke, he instinctively looked at the clock. Its shattered face looked back at him, jarring him, forcing his eyes open in after-sleep terror. The robot hummed and emitted a spark. He kept his eyes open. The humming ceased. His eyes began to burn. He knew he couldn't keep them open too long. The burning worked its way to the front of his eyes from the top and bottom, bringing with it tears. It felt as though someone was shoving needles into the corneas. The tears ran down over his cheeks. His eyes snapped shut. The roaring grew in his ears. The robot didn't make a sound. Could it be inoperative? Could it have worn down to immobility? Could he take the chance of experimenting? He slid down to a more comfortable position. The robot charged forward the instant he moved. He froze in mid-movement, his heart a chunk of ice. The robot stopped, confused, a scant 10 inches from his outstretched foot. The machine hummed to itself, the noise of it coming both from the machine in front of him and from somewhere behind the wall. He was suddenly alert. If it had been working correctly, there would have been little or no sound from the appendage and none whatsoever from the brain, but it was not working properly, and the sound of its thinking was distinct. The robot rolled backward, its eyes still toward Terence. The sense orbs of the machine were in the torso, giving the machine the look of a squat metal gargoyle, squared and deadly. The humming was growing louder. Every now and then, a sharp pfft of sparks mixed with it. Terence had a moment's horror at the thought of a short circuit, a fire in the life hutch, and no service robot to put it out. He listened carefully, trying to pinpoint the location of the robot's brain built into the wall. Then he thought he had it. Or was it there? It was either in the wall behind a bulkhead next to the refrigerator or behind a bulkhead near the relay machines. The two possible housings were within a few feet of each other, but they might make a great deal of difference. The distortion created by the steel plate in front of the brain and the distracting background noise of the robot broadcasting it made it difficult to tell exactly which was the correct location. He drew a deep breath. The ribs slid a fraction of an inch together, their broken ends grinding. He moaned, a high-pitched, tortured moan that died quickly but throbbed back and forth inside his head, echoing and building itself into a paean of sheer agony. It forced his tongue out of his mouth, limp in a corner of his lips, moving slightly. The robot rolled forward. He drew his tongue in, clamped his mouth shut, cut off the scream inside his head at its high point. The robot stopped, rolled back to its duty niche. Oh, God, the pain. God, God, where are you, pain? Beads of sweat broke out on his body. He could feel their tickle inside his spacesuit, inside his jumper, inside the body shirt, on his skin. The pain of the ribs was suddenly heightened by an irresistible itching of his skin. He moved infinitesimally within the suit, his outer appearance giving no indication of the movement. The itching did not subside. The more he tried to make it stop, the more he thought about not thinking about it, the worse it became. His armpits, the crooks of his arms, his thighs where the tight service pants clung, suddenly too tightly, were madness. He had to scratch. He almost started to make the movement. He stopped before he started. He knew he would never live to enjoy any relief. A laugh bubbled into his head. God almighty, and I always laughed at the slobs who suffered with the 7-year itch. The ones who always did a little dance when they were at attention during inspection. The ones who could scratch and sigh contentedly. God, how I envy them. His thoughts were taking on a wild sound, even to him. The prickling did not stop. He twisted faintly. It got worse. He took another deep breath. The ribs sandpapered again. This time, blessedly, he fainted from the pain.
"Well, Terence, how do you like your first look at Kyban?"
Ernie Terence wrinkled his forehead and ran a finger up the side of his face. He looked at his commander and shrugged.
"Fantastic things, aren't they?"
"Why fantastic?"
"Because they're just like us, except, of course, the bright yellow pigmentation and the tentacle fingers. Other than that, they're identical to a human being."
The commander opaqued the examination casket and drew a cigarette from a silver case, offering the lieutenant one. He puffed it alight, staring with one eye closed against the smoke.
"More than that, I'm afraid. Their insides look like someone had taken them out, liberally mixed them with spare parts from several other species, and jammed them back in any way that fitted conveniently. For the next 20 years, we'll be knocking our heads together trying to figure out their metabolic raison d'etre."
Terence grunted, rolling his unlit cigarette absently between two fingers.
"That's the least of it."
"You're right," agreed the commander. "For the next 1,000 years, we'll be trying to figure out how they think, why they fight, what it takes to get along with them, what motivates them."
"If they'd let us live that long," thought Terence.
"Why are we at war with the Kyban?" he asked the older man. "I mean, really?"
"Because the Kyban want to kill every human being they can recognize as a human being."
"What have they got against us?"
"Does it matter? Maybe it's because our skin isn't bright yellow. Maybe it's because our fingers aren't silken and flexible. Maybe it's because our cities are too noisy for them. Maybe a lot of maybes, but it doesn't matter. Survival never matters until you have to survive."
Terence nodded. He understood. So did the Kyban. It grinned at him and drew its blaster. It fired point blank, crimsoning the hull of the Kyban ship. He swerved to avoid running into his gun's own backlash, the movement of the bucket seat sliding in its tracks, keeping his vision steady while maneuvering, made him dizzy. He closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them, the abyss was nearer, and he teetered, his lips whitening as they pressed together under his effort to steady himself. With a headlong gasp, he fell, sighing, into the stomach. His long, silken fingers jointed, steely humming clankingly toward the medicine chest, over the plate behind the bulkhead. The robot advanced on him, grindingly. Small, fine bits of metal rubbed together, ashing away into a breeze that came from nowhere as the machine raised lead boots toward his face. Onward and onward, till he had no room to move, and then the light came on, bright, brighter than any star Terence had ever seen, glowing, broiling, flickering, shining, bobbing a ball of light on the chest of the robot who staggered, stumbled, stepped. The robot hissed, hummed, and exploded into a million flying, racing fragments, shooting beams of light all over the abyss over which Terence again teetered, teetering. He flailed his arms wildly, trying to escape, but at the last moment, before the fall, he awoke with a start. He saved himself only by his unconscious. Even in the hell of a nightmare, he was aware of the situation. He had not moaned and writhed in his delirium. He had kept motionless and silent. He knew it was true, because he was still alive. Only his surprised jerking as he came back to consciousness started the monster rolling from its niche. He came fully awake and sat, silent, slumped against the wall. The robot retreated. Thin breath came through his nostrils. Another moment, and he would have put an end to the past 3 days. 3 days or more now. How long had he been asleep? Days of torture. He was hungry. Lord, how hungry he was. The pain in his side was worse now, a steady throbbing that made even shallow breathing torturous. He itched maddeningly. He was uncomfortably slouched against a cold steel bulkhead, every rivet having made a burrow for itself in his skin. He wished he was dead. He didn't wish he was dead. It was all too easy to get his wish. If he could only disable that robot brain. A total impossibility. If he could only wear Phobos and Deimos for watch fobs. If he could only shack up with a silicon Deb from Panaris. If he could only use his large colon for a lasso. It would take a thorough destruction of the brain to do it enough damage to stop the appendage before it could roll over and smash Terence again. With a steel bulkhead between him and the brain, his chances of success totaled minus zero every time. He considered which part of his body the robot would smash first. One blow of that tool hand would kill him if it was used a second time. With the state of his present wounds, even a strong breath might finish him. Perhaps he could make a break and get through the lock into the decompression chamber. Worthless. A, the robot would catch him before he had gotten to his feet in his present condition. B, even allowing a miracle, even if he did get through the lock, the robot would smash the lock port, letting in air, ruining the mechanism. C, even allowing a double miracle, and it didn't, what the hell good would it do him? His helmet and gloves were in the hutch itself, and there was no place to go on the planetoid. The ship was ruined, so no signal could be sent from there. Doom suddenly compounded itself. The more he thought about it, the more certain he was that soon the light would flicker out for him. The light would flicker out. The light would flicker. The light. Light. Oh, God. Is it possible? Can it be? Have I found an answer? He marveled at the simplicity of it. It had been there for more than 3 days waiting for him to use it. It was so simple. It was magnificent. He could hardly restrain himself from moving just out of sheer joy. I'm not brilliant. I'm not a genius. Why did this occur to me? For a few minutes, the brilliance of the solution staggered him. Would a less intelligent man have solved the problem this easily? Would a more intelligent man have done it? Then he remembered the dream, the light in the dream. He hadn't solved the problem, his unconscious had. The answer had been there all the time, but he was too close to see it. His mind had been forced to devise a way to tell him. Luckily, it had. And finally, he didn't care how he had uncovered it. His God, if he had had anything to do with it, had heard him. Terence was by no means a religious man, but this was miracle enough to make him a believer. It wasn't over yet, but the answer was there, and it was an answer. He began to save himself. Slowly, achingly slowly, he moved his right hand, the hand away from the robot's sight, to his belt. On the belt hung the assorted implements a spaceman needs at any moment in his ship, a wrench, a packet of sleep stavers, a compass, a Geiger counter, a flashlight. The last was the miracle. Miracle in a tube. He fingered it almost reverently, then unclipped it in a moment's frenzy, still immobile to the robot's eyes. He held it at his side, away from his body by a fraction of an inch, pointing up over the bulge of his space-suited leg. If the robot looked at him, all it would see would be the motionless bulk of his leg, blocking off any movement on his part. To the machine, he was inert, motionless. Now, he thought wildly, where is the brain? If it's behind the relay machines, I'm still dead. If it's near the refrigerator, I'm saved. He could afford to take no chances. He would have to move. He lifted one leg. The robot moved toward him. The humming and sparking were more distinct this time. He dropped the leg. Behind the plates above the refrigerator. The robot stopped nearly at his side. Seconds had decided. The robot hummed, sparked, and returned to its niche. Now he knew. He pressed the button. The invisible beam of the flashlight leaped out, speared the bulkhead above the refrigerator. He pressed the button again and again, the flat circle of light appearing, disappearing on the faceless metal of the life hutch's wall. The robot sparked and rolled from its niche. It looked once at Terence. Its rollers changed direction in an instant, and the machine ground toward the refrigerator. The steeled fist swung in a vicious arc, smashing with a deafening clang at the spot where the light bubble flickered on and off. It swung again and again, till the bulkhead had been gouged and crushed and opened, and the delicate coils and plates and circuits and Memorex modules behind it were refuse and rubble, until the robot froze, with arm half ready to strike again. Dead. Immobile. Brain and appendage. Even then, Terence didn't stop pressing the flashlight button. Wildly, he thumbed it again and again and again. Then he realized it was all over. The robot was dead. He was alive. He would be saved. He had no doubts about that. Now he could cry. The medicine chest grew large through the shimmering in his eyes. The relay machines smiled at him. "God bless you, little life hutch," he thought, before he fainted.